From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern on why the city's creating a legal defense fund for immigrants.
Because it is very clear that the White House and Congress are certainly not going to protect the most vulnerable in our community and, in fact, are waging a war against them.
Also today, some Massachusetts public defenders rally at courthouses to be able to collectively bargain. And James Carroll joins us to discuss his new novel, The Cloister. Plus, some 800 new words are added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, including this one.
There is something called mansplaining. Have you heard about this?
We know what mansplaining is.
Mansplaining is when a man will condescendingly explain something to a woman that she already knows.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Cambridge has become the latest U.S. city to form a legal defense fund for immigrants. Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern says the fund will distribute grants to nonprofits that provide legal help to those who are particularly vulnerable, such as DACA recipients or victims of sexual violence. And Mayor McGovern is with us in studio to talk about this. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we're seeing more of these legal defense funds for immigrants, Chicago, San Francisco, New York City, Boston, right? New York City last April announced a $10 million immigrant defense legal fund. Boston has, I think, $1 million in its fund, at least at the end of October. Why Cambridge?
Well, Cambridge, we have a number of immigrants in our community. We've been a sanctuary city since 1985. We were one of the first sanctuary cities in the country. And although the symbolism of being a sanctuary city is important because it sends a message to immigrants in our community that they're going to be treated fairly and safe, we also believe that we have to – it's more than just that, and we have to stand by those values. And so as we see a administration in the White House that is consistently attacking immigrants, both documented and undocumented, we feel that – and I felt that it's really urgent for municipalities – to step to the plate because we're certainly not going to get any help from the federal government.
You know, if you look at census figures, I think it doesn't show a huge amount of diversity, right? In Cambridge, I think it's 71% white or something along those lines. So some folks might say, why do you need this if you look at that in terms of being a city of Cambridge being a city of immigrants?
Yeah. Well, Cambridge is, I mean, we have a long history of supporting immigrants and diversity in our community. You know, it's also hard to get figures on how many undocumented folks are in your community because undocumented people are not going to come to the government and say, I'm undocumented, right? Even if you are a sanctuary city. So, you know, it's been a little complicated to kind of figure out exactly what the need is going to be. But we certainly know that we have undocumented folks in our community. But again, it's also the way this administration has gone after immigrants. You're talking about DACA recipients now. You're talking about people losing temporary protective status or TPS. These are folks, many of whom are documented, who are now facing deportation. We heard from a gentleman yesterday at our press conference who is a DACA recipient, has been in this country his entire life. He runs the Boys and Girls Club in Somerville. The United States is the only home he's ever known. And if DACA gets rescinded, as Mr. Trump wants to do, he's a law-abiding citizen. He's never been arrested. He could be picked up just walking down the street and sent back to a country that he's never known. So that's a problem, and that's something that we have to take a stand against and resist.
Hmm. So how much is in the fund right now? I know you just started it.
Yeah, we just started. We have just over $50,000. Our goal is to raise $500,000, and then that money is going to be used. There'll be a grant review process that will be led by the Cambridge Community Foundation, who we partnered with. And it'll go to nonprofits who are doing legal services work with immigrants. So it's not – someone's not going to walk in off the street and say, can you give me a check to hire an attorney? We're going to be working with known, reputable experienced organizations for two reasons. One, to make sure that people know that the money that they're contributing is going to be accounted for and spent wisely. But also, immigration law is something that is very specific. It's not every attorney can do it or is allowed to do it. And so we want to make sure that immigrants are getting the proper representation.
In other cities like Los Angeles, for example, there's been some debate about who might qualify to access the fund. And they're saying immigrants with violent criminal histories may not be able to get legal help from the fund. Have you established criteria like that in Cambridge yet, or are you still in the midst of drawing up what the criteria might be for who would be able to get this type of legal aid?
Yeah, some of that is still being worked out. An important thing to note is that if someone is facing deportation, that is considered a civil offense, mm-hmm. not a criminal. So if you're a low-income immigrant who is facing a deportation charge, you don't get assigned a court-appointed attorney the way someone in a criminal case would get assigned a court-appointed attorney. So the majority, it's only about 14% of detained immigrants have legal representation, and about 30% of in the general population have legal representation. That number is even lower when you talk about low-income immigrants facing deportation. So most often you have these individuals, some of whom speak the language, some of whom don't, who are forced to defend themselves against the weight of the federal government and their prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it doesn't turn out well for them. So the other way to look at this is that being able to provide people with legal representation so that they have a fair hearing is probably about as American as you can get. And mm-hmm. so we want to make sure people at least have a fair opportunity to make their case.
But if someone was facing deportation proceedings because of a criminal offense, perhaps a violent criminal offense, because I know those are other categories of what mm-hmm. offense, you know, prompts immediate deportation, would there be a provision to say we're not going to support the legal fights from those folks? Or no, Cambridge isn't going there?
I think we're still going to – we will talk about – I think we would have some issue with – and I wish Gita from the Cambridge Foundation was here because she's – they're administering – they're putting the grant process together. I think if someone was facing a violent – was being charged with a violent crime, that's a different conversation. Mm-hmm. That's another misconception that people have just about sanctuary cities.
But it's the fight we've been hearing,
right? And it's all misinformation, mm-hmm. And I think the term sanctuary city is confusing because when people think sanctuary, what they tend to think about is that you are giving safe harbor to someone who has done something wrong. If someone is arrested for a criminal offense, even in a sanctuary city, their immigration status is turned over to the federal government. What it means is if a Cambridge police officer stops someone for a traffic violation, they're not going to ask their legal status mm-hmm. in that case. If a parent comes in to register their child at school, the Cambridge Public Schools are not going to ask their immigration status. But if someone were to commit a violent crime, that's a whole other avenue.
Mm-hmm. And just because it's related, and I'm curious here, there's a lot of talk about marijuana laws mm-hmm. And whether to model sanctuary cities laws for marijuana after sanctuary cities laws that are in place for immigrants. Do you think Cambridge should think about something like that? Because we have some uncertainty here in Massachusetts because of comments from our U.S. attorney about whether federal law enforcement officials might, in fact, prosecute marijuana crimes because marijuana is to be legalized this summer.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't, we've had some, actually this came up at our city council meeting last night.
Oh, really?
to have a conversation about enforcement and how we're going to enforce the marijuana law and cannabis law. And, I'm not sure I want Cambridge police officers spending their time chasing people down for, smoking a joint that's now legal. I think there are other things we can do. And whether or not the federal government's going to come in to Cambridge, then I think we'll cross that bridge. But, we have a lot of other things our officers need to be spending their time on.
All right. Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern, he announced the city's new legal defense fund for immigrants yesterday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Meantime, some public defenders across Massachusetts rallied outside courthouses today for collective bargaining rights. They say addressing their pay should be part of criminal justice reform efforts in Massachusetts. Among those who rallied is attorney Ben Evans, who's on the line now. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Deb, thanks for having me on your show.
So tell us about what happened this morning. I guess you were at courthouses in Northampton, Fall River, and Boston?
Yes, and this is kind of the second go-round in recent months. Back in November, we were in Springfield, Worcester, and Roxbury.
Mm-hmm. And what are you asking for?
Well, Deb, fundamentally, we're asking for fairness. Mm-hmm. The employees of the Massachusetts Public Defender Agency, which happens to have this unusual name of the Committee for Public Counsel Services, but for all intents and purposes, we're mass defenders, we're asking for fairness. We're asking for exactly the same fundamental rights that employees of every other Massachusetts statewide agency have had for decades. And that is specifically the right to collectively bargain and to seek the protections of a contract. And we think it's only fair that we get the same rights that employees of other Massachusetts state agencies have had for so long.
And you're talking about 750 or so people of the Committee for Public Counsel Services, and it's not just attorneys, it's other employees as well. Is that right?
From the very beginning, I became a public defender in Massachusetts in 2005 and became involved in this struggle. And from the very beginning, it was secretaries, it was administrative assistants, it was social service advocates, it was investigators,
okay,
it was everybody.
Okay, what's the average salary of a public defender, Ben?
That figure I don't have for you.
but I'm wondering...
This issue is not, although it is obviously related to money, it's really about more than money. It's about having the kind of predictability that you get with having a contract. It's about having a voice.
I get that. But for our listeners, you know, who are not attorneys or maybe don't need a public defender, tell us, you know, roughly why you should make more and what effect this has on the justice system if you don't.
So this particular struggle is not specifically focused on us trying to get more money. Really, we're fighting for our clients and for ourselves. Every day in court, we're advocating for the poorest and most vulnerable people in the Commonwealth. People who are accused of crimes, obviously they have a constitutional right to a lawyer under the famous Gideon versus Wainwright decision of 1963, U.S. Supreme Court. And Commonwealth of Massachusetts, our state, has an obligation, a constitutional obligation to provide those people with lawyers. And the problem is that when you have all these great young, a lot of them young, newer lawyers who come in, they're enthusiastic, they're doing this work, but they're also facing tremendous debt from law school loans, and sometimes they can't afford to keep doing this work. They leave after we've, you know, trained them and mentored them, and they're really doing good work. They leave. Whatever clients they're representing have to have new lawyers assigned. Some people end up with, you know, like three or four lawyers on a case. That creates what I feel is unnecessary delays, just because we're of attrition. We're losing people because they don't have that predictability of knowing I'll get a cost of living increase.
And some folks have made that same argument about prosecutors. And their salaries, their average salaries have been published. And I want to say there's something like $40,000 for a new assistant district attorney who's prosecuting cases. And they say that their salaries need to be raised because it does similar things. It stalls the criminal justice proceedings when there has to be a change of prosecutor. And then, you know, it's also they're losing talented lawyers because they're in so much debt and they can't afford to live on those salaries.
Well, Deb, I can't give you specifics, but I can tell you that our salaries are exactly in line with that. It's more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also tell you that, you know, the district attorneys are in a very different position. They're elected, right? So they're elected in each of the counties in, you know, whatever, Hampden County, Bristol County, Suffolk County. And so as elected officials, they have a lot of discretion, right, about, you know, how they set their budgets, and because they're implementing policy, right? Whereas for those of us who are mass defenders, were employees, direct employees of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We work for a statewide agency. Mm. And so our argument is that we should be treated the same as other employees of statewide agencies.
Right, right. And so right now, the reason that you're prohibited from collective bargaining is what?
Well, unfortunately, when our elected representatives in, I think, 1984 passed Massachusetts General Laws Chapter 211D, they failed to specify in that statute who our employer is. So what the Massachusetts Labor Relations Board has claimed is, well, you don't have a statutorily defined employer, so if you can't collectively bargain because we don't know who'd be sitting across the table from you. Mm. I mean, I think that's a lot of baloney because, of course, we have a employer. It's the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. There is certainly, a management structure for our agency, just like every other agency.
You know, a recent audit from State Auditor Suzanne Bump followed up on an audit that was done about 7 years ago. And the first audit from 7 years ago said 98% of the courts in Massachusetts were not following guidelines to determine a defendant's ability to pay for an attorney. And now this recent audit from Bump 7 years later says, well, there have been some improvements, but CPCS needs to also fix the way it documents money. I mean, I'm just wondering, is oversight an issue here? And if oversight improved, do you think that would change things? Or how do you view these issues?
Deb, I don't think oversight is the issue here. Hmm. We need the right to collectively bargain and seek the protections of a contract, just like all the other employees of statewide agencies in the Commonwealth. But also, keep in mind, Committee for Public Counsel Services is absolutely not in charge of evaluating people to see if they qualify for appointing counsel. Hmm. That's not in our mandate. It's not our job. In Massachusetts, it's the probation department and the courts that are determining whether people are eligible for appointing counsel. If they are, then we fight for them and we advocate for them as best we can. You know, whether it's a criminal case, whether it's a situation where, you know, families are in danger of being separated, care and protection cases, that type of thing, whether it's an issue of a civil commitment for mental health issues or substance use disorder or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we're not determining who's eligible for appointed counsel. So
I understand, but obviously when the state auditor is raising questions about oversight of how public defense is determined and what happens with, I think it's there are certain fees now for public defenders and what happens with that money. I mean, I'm just saying, are there improvements that need to be made when we're talking about paying more money or potentially to CPCS if collective bargaining is allowed?
Right. Well, that would be further on down the road. That's a whole other issue. Whether we would able, we'd be able to increase salaries if we had a collective bargaining agreement or a contract. But as far as a rationale for denying us those rights, mm-hmm. I don't think that makes sense to say maybe there's more oversight needed in a different branch of government, saying that they need to do a better job of evaluating people. And also, let's keep in mind, when the police stop you and say, these are your Miranda rights. If you cannot afford a counsel, one will be appointed to represent you. They don't say, oh, and by the way, we're going to see, what you can contribute to that. I think that if the government wants to take away someone's liberty, they do, under our Constitution, have an obligation to provide a lawyer, and a good one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ben Evans, public defender here in Massachusetts. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, James Carroll discusses his new novel, The Cloister. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. One of history's great love stories, coupled with some deep philosophical and theological ruminating, all run through James Carroll's new novel, The Cloister, which is out today. The historical novel follows the famous romance between Peter Abelard and Heloise in 12th century France, and a post-World War II friendship between a fictional priest and a woman who survived a Nazi concentration camp. The book raises various questions about faith, love, and identity. James Carroll's the author of 12 novels, 8 works of nonfiction, and he's a former Catholic priest. He joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Glad to be here.
So what inspired you to write this novel?
Well, how to answer that? Let me start with the present moment.
Mm.
We live in a moment when we in the West are cursed with the idea that violence is virtuous. Violence is built into the human condition, I know, but in Western culture, Christendom especially, the great tradition of Christianity, an idea took hold of the Western imagination that violence can be the will of God. This novel begins with that idea. God wills it was the motto of the Crusades. Peter Abelard and Heloise, to whom you just referred in the introduction, are at the center of the novel. They lived during the time of the First into the Second Crusade, when this idea was gripping the Western imagination. Peter Abelard has been a figure in my own imagination for decades. I grew up during the Vietnam War years. Peter Abelard is a person who said no to the idea that God wills violence. And that's what made him first important to me. His romance with Heloise, of course, is what made him a legend in the West. They are the Romeo and Juliet of France, in a way. Their letters are some of the great love literature of Western culture. Mm. But what was important to me was they stood together at a fork in the road. And at that fork, Christendom, the West, the church, our culture, took a wrong turn down the road of sacred violence that led ultimately to the wars against Islam, which continue, and also to the deep violent antagonisms toward Jews, which culminated, of course, in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So it's a medieval story, but it's of interest to us because of its legacy in the present day.
Remind us a little bit, though, about some of, you know, what they stood up to at that time and what they were facing and who they were, really, how they met. Some folks might not know this story.
Yeah, well, Peter Abelard was the greatest teacher in Europe. He was the most famous, hard to figure a contemporary person, but he was the most famous thinker and teacher. He was at the what became the University of Paris. It was the cathedral school at Notre Dame, the cathedral in Paris, the very place that on which the present-day cathedral stands. And students came from all over Europe to study with him. He was a brilliant, charismatic thinker. The canon of the cathedral, the man in charge, the cleric, and Peter Abelard himself was a cleric, asked him to take on as a private pupil his niece, 18, 19, 20 years old, we don't know for sure, Heloise. Peter Abelard took her on as his pupil. He was probably around 40. They fell in love. They had a great romance. It came to a quick and tragic end when Heloise's uncle learned about their romance. He had thugs attack Abelard. Abelard was castrated. Abelard effectively went into the monastery in exile. Heloise exiled herself in a convent. They became a monk, a nun. And then that's when their story began, because that's when they began to exchange these letters that we have. Letters from the early 12th century, written in Latin. It was before the language of French really had taken hold in the culture. And they are some of the most powerful expressions of human longing, human regret, human affirmation. Heloise herself, one of the great figures of our culture, a woman unashamed, strong, standing up to him and to the whole culture. Together they stood against the waves of sacred violence that swept over Europe and the church at that moment. So that's, in a nutshell, their story. She is faithful to him right to the end. His rejection of the prevailing violent theology led to his being condemned at a church council, condemned as a heretic, hounded to death, in effect. She took his remains to her convent, where she was the abbess by then, one of the great figures in the church in Europe. She buried him on the grounds of her abbey. And then 20 years later, when she died, she was entombed with him. Their remains are said to have been brought to Paris in the early 19th century. And if you go into the Père Lachaise Cemetery in the heart of Paris today, you'll find a great, beautiful mausoleum tomb where the remains of Abelard Nelouise are said to reside, one of the great stories of France. So that's a long-winded way of saying an old theological story with profound contemporary relevance.
Right. But you pair this story with the story of a post-World War II priest,
yes,
who befriends a docent at the,
yes,
Cloisters Museum in New York, the,
right,
actual museum in New York, and who's a Nazi concentration camp survivor. And so then,
right,
you bring these stories of Abelard and Heloise alive through this friendship as well. And,
right,
why do it that way? Why did you decide that that was the way you wanted to do it?
Well, I knew I wanted a contemporary story to bring home the relevance of this medieval story. And, of course, the Holocaust is the great revelation in the West of this deep current of the consequences of sacred violence, the idea that God wills, in a particular way, the death of Jews. A perversion, of course. Nazi anti-Semitism was a perversion of Christian anti-Judaism. I don't mean to equate the two, but Nazi anti-Semitism couldn't have happened without being prepared for by religious anti-Judaism in the church. That idea that Abelard stood against, well, where did it go? What did it lead to? What is the ultimate consequence of the notion that God has rejected the Jews and that Christians can feel justified in attacking them? Well, frankly, it comes to the Holocaust. So it was very, and this has been a kind of haunting theme of mine my whole adult life. I've written 20 books. Half of them have dealt with this question. It was very clear to me that this story had to somehow engage with the Holocaust. The priest in this story, Father Michael Cavanaugh, works in an Irish Catholic working class parish in the upper tip of Manhattan. He's naive. He's a man who comes into this history, comes in even in 1950, comes in even into a full recognition of what the church's relationship to the Holocaust was. Mm. And he's brought into that reckoning by his encounter with this woman, Rachel Vedette, who had been imprisoned in the Nazi camp in Drancy in Paris, whose father died there, and who was traumatized there in ways that are not resolved until, oddly enough, she encounters this priest. And together, they begin to reckon with unresolved and unanswered questions, each in their own way, each in different ways. Mm-hmm. But together, they come to a fuller reckoning of who they are and who they want to be. And for both of them, a confrontation with the story of Abelard and Heloise is pivotal.
Hmm. I guess I wonder, you know, why do this in it? You've mentioned you've written 20 books.
I think at least.
Why,
yeah,
do this in the form of a novel? What is it about the novel that lets you get at certain truths here that you wouldn't be able to in another form of writing?
Well, fiction does enable us to get at deep truths differently than works of nonfiction. I am a fiction writer. It's how I began my life as a writer. It's a kind of native language for me. I could have written a simple biography of Abelard or another rendition of the story of Abelard and Heloise, but I wanted to reckon with the relationship between the issues they confronted and the issues we confront today. And unless I was going to write a long polemical political essay, that was going to be almost impossible for me to do. Mm-hmm. By telling a story, inventing characters who have a problem and who pursue a solution to their problem, I'm able to, in effect, deal with my own problem. My own problem as a Catholic, believing Catholic, has long been, how did my church get corrupted in such a way as to be complicit in the Holocaust? A separate but related question is, how did my own church get corrupted in such a way that so many figures of the clergy could abuse children and be protected by bishops?
And your book brings up the whole clergy abuse and protecting abuses.
It's true. It has to be an issue in this story because it's related.
Right.
The power structure that the church created for itself in the name of God has an inhuman aspect that must be confronted. We've learned that the hard way now in relation to the sex abuse crisis. We should have learned it more fully a generation and a half ago in relationship to the church's failure during the Holocaust. Mm. As a Catholic, these are deep, deep issues that go to the core of who I am. By writing a story, creating characters who are not myself, but who are grappling with the same questions, I discovered the freedom to pursue the questions wherever they lead. And the truth is, they may lead to places that I myself would be reluctant to go because the characters begin to take charge of the story and I follow it where they tell me to follow it. That's both the pleasure and the challenge of being a novelist.
You know, we've spoken with you quite a bit about the clergy abuse crisis here, and you wrote recently in The New Yorker about the death of Cardinal Bernard Law when he died late last year. And you said that, if I have a little paragraph of it here, you said Law's attempt to bind the deadly secret failed. At a time when the voices of women especially resolutely refused to be silenced, the Catholic hierarchy's own attempt to keep the secret of its sexualized power will fail too. Law, despite himself, was the harbinger of the coming truth.
It's true, and the emphasis there is on the role of women.
Right.
Women are leading the church's reckoning with its deep corruption. Women must be more fully brought into power structures in the church. The failure to ordain women is an absurd and blatant example of ongoing church bigotry toward women, misogyny. That's not unrelated to the fact that the two most powerful characters in the novel I've written are women. Eloise herself, mm-hmm. who in effect makes Abelard be Abelard. She calls him to the fray, challenges him to speak the truth as he sees it, which is a truth that runs counter to the crusading truth, the violent God truth that is sweeping through the imagination of the church at that moment. With Eloise prodding him, he challenges that idea and goes on the record for us against it. So the great meaning of the Abelard-Eloise story is this history of the last 1,000 years of Christendom culminating in the Holocaust could have gone another way. And once we understand that it could have gone another way, we realize it can go another way yet going forward. So Eloise is a key figure in this, and so is Rachel Vidette, the woman who is the docent in the cloisters, the museum of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who is a Holocaust survivor, but who has come out of her experience seared with a clear, crystal clear grasp of the truth of the meaning of the abuse of power, the meaning of the abuse of religion, the meaning of cultural prejudice and where it leads. And her searing grasp of that truth is what staggers Father Michael Cavanaugh in relationship to this woman. It's as if the illusions which he's embraced are burned away and his life has to change.
Right. I'm wondering, though, do you think, though, that the Catholic Church, I mean, it almost seems, you know, immune to change, if you will, right? I mean, this is what you're grappling with. This is what the storyline that you're looking at in this book, and you're saying, my church, it could go one way or the other, but it tends to go this way, and it really bothers me when it goes this way, and we aren't, as a church, letting go of that violent past, and we're hanging on to that power structure that allows these things to happen. Is that going to change?
Well, if I actually believe that, Deborah, I wouldn't be a Catholic anymore. How could I?
Well, that's what I'm asking, I guess.
I see a profound change underway in the church. Right now, we're living through it. It seems slow and unsteady and one step forward, two steps back. But that's the way an institution like this does change. The most important change in the, not just in my lifetime, but in, I would argue, in the history of Christianity, took place at the Second Vatican Council when the igniting charge against the Jewish people that generated centuries of anti-Jewish violence, that they were the Christ killers, that charge was renounced. That charge is embedded in the Gospels, Deborah. That's not just doctrine. That's not just saying divorced people can't go to communion. This is much more profound than any of the stuff we Catholics argue about normally. We're saying God has not turned God's face against the Jewish people. For most of 2,000 years, that was solid Catholic belief. The Second Vatican Council said no to that. That's the beginning of the dismantling of this power structure. The other thing the Second Vatican Council did is it turned the just war church into a peace church. The Roman Catholic Church, on a dime, in reaction to its own failure during the Holocaust, has renounced its own commitment to solving political conflict through violence. I can't tell you how important that change is. These other things that we mostly argue about, sexual morality, the place of women in whether they can be ordained or not, all of these things are secondary importance compared to these much larger things. So the vision that Peter Abelard had, a peace church, Jesus Christ, not the warrior at the end of the world, but the Prince of Peace, that vision can reform, reconstitute, reinvent the Catholic imagination. And it's happening. So 100 years from now, there will be women priests. 100 years from now, the power structure of the church will be dismantled in some important way. It's underway. Can I guarantee it? No, of course not. But it's a vital, lively hope. And there are plenty of ways to see the possibility of it unfolding right before us, not the least of which is the arrival 5 years ago this month of Pope Francis.
So you know, I'd like to bring that up because I did just read a poll about Pope Francis. I know it's a poll, but, you know, it shows that he's very popular, even among people who are not Catholic. But it also says that there seems to be an increasing number of Catholics who are very concerned that there is this divide of conservative and liberals, and that perhaps he's taking things too far for what many people might consider comfortable.
Yes.
So is he the face of reform? And, of course, there's the whole current controversy about what happened in Chile.
Yes,
you know,
true.
Over the clergy abuse crisis there. You know, is Pope Francis really reform? And what gives you the satisfaction that the answer to that is yes?
Well, two large questions there. One about Francis himself. The other about the division in the church. Let me take that second one first.
Okay.
The church, the Catholic Church, Christianity in general, is a human institution. So there should be no surprise that there's a division in it. We think of it right now as a right-left division. But the church has been divided against itself from the beginning. We see that in the records of the foundational documents, the Gospels. St. Peter and St. Paul had a ferocious argument rendered in the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles. There was a ferocious argument over the place of Jews in relationship to the people of Jesus. The church has been arguing with itself about Jews and its relationship to the Jewish people from the beginning. No surprise that that should be happening now. There are these other questions embedded in that big question. The place of women has been controversial in the church from the beginning, which is why you see a lot of confusion in the New Testament about the role of Mary Magdalene, who was the most intimate partner of Jesus. She was his most trusted friend. She was the one to whom Jesus is said to have appeared first. She was one of the few, the only people who didn't abandon Jesus in his hour of need were women. The church has downplayed that, but you can see that tension right there in the beginning. So the division is there. It's lively. That just means that we are a human institution and we resolve things not by obliterating our antagonist, violence, the will of God. No, by working through our disagreements, sometimes with fierce argument, always with civility, always with charity, one hopes. And that's the importance of Francis. He represents that. It isn't that Francis is immune from corruptions of the church. He's a man of the church. Of course he's reflecting them. He made a terrible mistake a month ago when he sided with the bishop in Chile instead of with the victim who was accusing the bishop. Mm. That was a terrible mistake. I think Francis, he was called on it, not incidentally, by Cardinal Law. I mean, I beg your pardon, by Cardinal O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
Francis shows signs of having regretted his mistake and is moving now to correct it. We've already seen, I would argue, a profound level of change from Francis. He has emphasized the experience of human beings over doctrinal rigidity. That's the meaning of his "Who am I to judge?" For a person of his position to have become kind of symbolized by that phrase is itself a signal of the change.
All right. Well, you know, we could talk for a very long time, but we don't have it, so we'll have to invite you back.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you
so much. James Carroll's the author of 12 novels and 8 works of nonfiction. His new book, The Cloister, is out today. He'll be talking about it tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. For more information, go to RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Recovery efforts from the weekend storm continue, and another nor'easter is headed our way, with snow expected to start tomorrow. For the latest forecast, WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein joins us via Skype. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
So when will this storm start?
So we've got some light precipitation, which will move in tomorrow during the morning hours. And after that, it will begin to get heavier and steadier. This is mostly a rainstorm for the Boston area, but it is a snowstorm for northern New England and areas especially west of 495, north of the Pike, and even further north up towards the Route 2 corridor. So it's a nor'easter, but it's a wet nor'easter for the coast, and it's a snowier nor'easter well inland.
Okay, when you say snowier, talk to me. What are we talking about in terms of accumulations, and where exactly might the snow be and the worst of it be?
Right. So the worst of it's going to be northern Worcester County, Leominster, Fitchburg, Lunenburg, on up into Jaffrey as you get into southern New Hampshire, anywhere from 6 to 12 inches. There'll be some spots which are in that 12 to 18 inch zone. So a foot to a foot and a half in the higher elevations up in that area. As you start coming closer to the 495, even in Worcester, I think we're looking at 3 to 6 inches. Maybe Worcester area ends up closer to the 6. But you get east of Worcester, you start trailing down. By the time you get into the 128, 495 belt, you're into the 3 to 6, 2 to 5, and it's going to trail off 1 to 3 inches in Boston. Now, I'm going 1 to 3 in the city, but I have to tell you, it would not surprise me if we got nothing in downtown Boston. So we'll see what happens. But you get the idea. This is not a snowstorm for Boston.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but we still have about, 11,000 people without power in the state at last check. So, this storm will likely cause outages again if you're talking about heavy, wet snow.
Absolutely. So, again, Worcester County, northern Middlesex County, Franklin County, absolutely, with this heavy, wet snow and gusty winds, there will be some power outages. The good news is, I think, that right from Cape Ann down through the city and even into Metro West, we should hold that snow totals down low enough that even with the wind, we shouldn't see extensive power outages. Now, all of this, of course, is dependent on the track of the storm going from just east of New York City and then up almost across southeastern New England and then into the Gulf of Maine. A wobble to the east would pull the cold air in. It would increase the snowfall totals greatly. A little wobble to the west, that 6 to 12 goes up into the New Hampshire-Massachusetts border and further north and west. So it's a very tight, the difference between 50 miles will be the difference between an inch and 12 inches of snow, and that's not hyperbole. That is probably what we will see.
Hmm. Okay, and this wobbly March snowstorm, when does it end, Dave?
So it winds down actually mid-evening tomorrow. I think there'll be some lighter rain or snow overnight tomorrow night. but the evening commute will be tough, especially leaving the city, headed north, headed west. It won't really be too much of a problem besides wind and rain if you're leaving Boston and heading back down towards the South Shore. I think heading down to Route 3, even down 24, probably some parts of 24 will have some snow tomorrow, but it's really the Mass Pike, 495, Route 3 North, 3A North, 95 North that will really have trouble tomorrow for that evening commute. Thursday, there'll be some leftover stuff in the morning, but I think we'll be able to clean up, and it looks drier and seasonable thereafter.
Okay. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein, I'm sure we'll hear from you again. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
The Merriam-Webster Dictionary has added hundreds of new words to its online version, words like embiggened and words such as...
This has been sort of a dumpster fire of an election campaign.
That's Dan Rather on CNN in November of 2016, opting for something beyond disaster to explain. Yes, dumpster fire. That's the word. It's among the new words in this Springfield-based dictionary. Also included... Well, here's a clip from HBO's Silicon Valley.
There is something called mansplaining. Have you heard about this?
We know what mansplaining is.
Mansplaining is when a man will condescendingly explain something to a woman that she already knows.
And joining us now from Springfield, hopefully not to mansplain, is Peter Sokolowski. He's editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so I already used a few of the words. Let's start with dumpster fire. Why did you decide that one needed to be included?
Well, you know, the reason for dumpster fire is actually the same for all of the words, and that is to say we look for a couple of criteria. We look for frequent use and we look for widespread use. In other words, is the word used very often, and then is it used by many different publications, different editors, different writers? And in this case, of course, dumpster fire is itself a meme. It's kind of something that spreads like fire, and it has become something that is used, as you know, very frequently with an image or a GIF or a GIF, if you will, of the named fire. But because it's used frequently in, and your clip was a perfect example, with if someone like a Dan Rather, someone who is speaking to a national audience from a platform like a network, then clearly this is a word that has entered the culture and it's time to enter the dictionary.
Was there a word there was a lot of debate about and ultimately you didn't include it?
Oh, that's a great question. You know what? We don't have debates as such. There is no advocacy per se. It's more like a conveyor belt. In other words, words that we notice might be used only infrequently at first, and then we watch them grow in usage. And so that what we basically simply do is say, you know what, it's not this year for this word. We'll wait for next year. We'll watch it a little bit longer. So that there are terms that we've been watching for years because every word grows at a different pace. That's what's interesting. Dumpster fire was coined in 2008, as far as we know. That makes it a very young word for, you know, the 1,000 years of English. And so we are watching how words enter the language on a continuous basis, and this word simply grew much more quickly than a lot of others.
I also noticed self-care.
You know, there's a lot of terms in the dictionary in the last 10, 15 years that have to do with, candidly, not only the aging population, but a different way of thinking about medical terminology, which is to say it's not just about the actual cures or treatments, but it's also about the business or the administration of healthcare. So words like, for example, hospitalist is a relatively new term in the dictionary. Self-care, care for oneself, which could be kind of a mental health term. It can also be used, of course, for patients who are maybe sent home a little earlier, but who are capable of doing continuing treatment for themselves. And it's a term that's used in a fairly technical way, and therefore, of course, it belongs in the dictionary.
Also, what about how online things are affecting language? Words like subtweet and cryptocurrency, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, there's a whole new, essentially a whole new vocabulary for currency on the internet after Bitcoin. Bitcoin entered in a couple of years ago, and now there's the initial coin offering, and cryptocurrency and blockchain, which is the sort of the software piece of it. you know, online communication has added a few things to the dictionary. One is speed. It just simply means that words and communication happens more quickly. But there's something else, too, and that is, I think people overlook this point, a lot of communication is happening in a written form, whether that's texting or Twitter. There's a lot more approximations of speech, if you will, casual conversations that happen in entirely a textual context. And that allows us as researchers, as lexicographers, to watch the language and see it move in real time a little bit more quickly than it used to happen, because, of course, it is happening more quickly.
Okay. Peter Sokolowski, he's editor-at-large of the Massachusetts-based Merriam-Webster Dictionary. He joined us today from the studios of New England Public Radio in Springfield. Peter, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna and Allison Bruzek, with help from Zoe Mitchell, Lily Tyson, and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.